This is Extraordinary Lives, a podcast from Lad Bible where we speak to people with a unique story to tell. I'm Ben Powell Jones, and coming up in this episode...
And the one thing you do learn in all of this is that you never go down, whatever you do. You go down and you are absolutely, completely and utterly fucked.
A warning that this episode contains content which you may find distressing. Hello and welcome to this episode of Extraordinary Lives, the podcast from Lad Bible. Today we're joined by James Bannon. Thanks for coming in, James.
No worries.
For anyone who doesn't know who you are, would you mind giving us a brief introduction?
Yeah, so I'm James Bannon. I'm best known as being an undercover police officer infiltrating Millwall football hooligans between 1987 to 1989.
So let's start right at the start. How do you get into undercover work?
I mean, I got selected... I'd been quite lucky. I got mentored really young as a young police officer by a really good sergeant.
What sort of age is this?
So I was 18, I was 19.
Wow. Wow.
So I just come out of training school. He saw something in me within sort of 6 weeks. I was on the area car, which is the big fast car that drives around in plain clothes as an observer, jumping out and doing various bits and pieces. And then within 18 months, I was in plain clothes working on a crime squad. Got special dispensation to do that.
What does that mean, special?
Well, normally probationary police officers aren't allowed to work in plain clothes for a select period of time or certainly for a long time. So I was working full-time in plain clothes at 18 months on a crime squad.
Wow, so he really did see
he did.
Something.
Yeah, he did.
And what do you think that was?
I just think he saw something in me and he took that and harnessed it and I got elevated and was working on an estate within a year, living in a squat.
But at that age, is that the usual age?
No. People-
Yeah.
It's really unusual. Yeah, no, it is. But it was, you know, if you think about it, it's quite a shrewd move, really.
Mm.
It's because you wouldn't expect somebody 19, 20 years old to be doing that.
Sure.
So actually it played to our advantage a little bit.
When you look back now and you say he saw something in you, what do you think that was? Like what ability do you think he saw?
I think he just could see that I was pretty arrogant and pretty confident.
Right.
Knew my stuff. And with an arrogance and confidence comes, you know, a bit of bravery and stuff. And I think there is that front of your head's not really sort of developed at that age properly. And, you know, you do under the age of like 25 tend to do all the crazy loony stuff because your head's not quite understanding that actually this could go seriously wrong. And I think there was a bit of that going on too.
That makes sense. So you get put in a squat... at that point, are you called an undercover officer?
No, I was just called a plainclothes officer then. Right. I was living in that squat. I lived in that squat for 3 months.
And when you say you lived in it, as in like you 24/7?
No.
Right.
No. So I'd start at 8 o'clock and finish at sort of 6 or 7 and go home. Right. It was a bit weird, but it worked. I mean, we were dealing with situations on an estate at that time. There was some big problems. So it was mainly stolen. So we were buying lots of stolen gear back.
So at that point, was it kind of drugs? Is that what you were?
There was not so much, but there were some drugs, but it was mainly stolen property at that point.
Okay.
At that time. So we were dealing with fencing of ultimately.
Okay, understood. I mean, that sounds frightening. And the thought of doing it as a 19-year-old sounds even more frightening. Was that something you felt or no?
It was just a job. And for me, and it was, and it just, it's like everything, it was just layers and layers and layers. So it becomes, you just become immune to it. It just, and you start, you have your tricks and you know, the way that you're going to get out of stuff. And as a result of that, it then rolled on and then moved on to working in a fully covert environment at 21.
So that was that kind of like almost like a trial phase where they were seeing how good you were at it?
No, I think it was just something that we chose to do at that time because we needed to try and sort it. It was the guy that I was working with, my mentor, ran the squad and we chose to do that. So that's what we did.
And so when you were in the squat, when you were on that job, were the people you were dealing with on a daily basis, did you see them as dangerous individuals or were you not afraid of them?
No, they were just people that are desperate and
okay,
and effectively were doing what they did in order to survive.
Right, I see.
The majority.
I see.
Not all, but the majority.
So they weren't. It wasn't necessarily a point then when you felt like you're in danger from the people you were.
All of it's dangerous.
Right.
It's just there's are various elements of how dangerous it gets.
Mm-hmm.
So that you would like, but it could, you know, at any minute, at any moment, it can turn and it can go horribly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So you're always on, you've always got a part of you that's looking from the outside, looking in as mm-hmm. to how you're going to deal with something should it go wrong.
Got you.
There is always that element. But do you become more relaxed? Do you become, yes, you do. You can't, it's just because of human nature. It's just the way that you are. You become used to it. And so therefore you become a bit more blasé,
mm-hmm.
but at that, but then you can never lose sight of the fact that ultimately where you're at is it can go horribly wrong at any minute.
Mm-hmm. And what does it look like? Can you tell us a bit about how you invent a cover story? Like, do they give you it? Is it a sheet you have to learn?
They should.
Right.
I mean, if we jump onto the football,
sure.
Is we were given nothing, absolutely nothing.
What? So you're told, okay, the job in the squad's done. That was great. Let's move on.
I then went on the crime squad.
Right.
I then went on the crime squad and was just working the local area dealing with crime,
mm-hmm.
But in plain clothes. I then got a phone call, went to the Scotland Yard, got interviewed, got told on the Monday that I was going on to a covert squad infiltrating football hooligans.
Did you feel any anxiety around that?
No.
Okay.
Turned up at Broccoli Police Station and they gave us an office in the police station above the front desk.
Right.
And which is 3 miles from, at that point, the den then as it was, Millwall's ground. And just told to get on with it.
So to someone on the outside of that, that sounds a bit strange that you would be...
To somebody from the inside, that was a bit fucking strange.
Okay.
So that from the outside is just unbelievable, really, mm. when you think about it. But it was just, you know, it wasn't really thought out. It wasn't particularly well managed. And we were just told to get on with it.
Mm. And was that, is that because that kind of football hooligan, undercover football hooligan work was new and there wasn't process for it? Or is that just the way it worked?
I think they just didn't take it seriously.
Right.
They didn't really understand the concepts of what we were trying to do.
Yeah.
And we were, you know, there was lots of great ideas, but it was just complete and utter mismanagement, completely. And, you know, they're asking people to go out to a football club into a group of people. Mainly, all men, who've known each other really pretty much all their lives and just turn up. And it's like, oh, I'm Jim from Wandsworth and you've never seen me before. You don't know who I am, but, you know, I'm a Millwall supporter and let me in your gang. And, yeah, I haven't got anything to back it up.
Yeah.
Effectively how it started.
Well, so you said a second ago, so what was the cover story? How are you given a cover story? How do you create your legend?
Your legend?
Yeah.
Is you create yourself. And so that's what I did. And I realised very, very quickly that we weren't going to get any help or assistance, so we were going to need to do it ourselves. So I had, for me, the only thing I had a business card, which my cover, which was Jim Ford, Spectrum Decorating, with an address that was an accommodation address in Croydon.
So they'd given you that?
No.
You'd made that yourself?
I got that made up.
Right.
But that's all I had. So it's a, hi, I'm Jim from Wandsworth and I'm thinking, and here's my business card. That was it.
Okay. And when you, God, because it sounds a little bit.
Yeah, it's shit.
Yes.
Yeah, well,
yeah, sure. But so how, like when they interviewed you for it, did you know it was going to be that lax? Like, did they say, oh, look, you're going to go in, figure it all out yourself. You're 21.
We were told, this is what we're looking to do. It's going to be a short-term operation. You're to go in, you're to infiltrate Millwall football hooligans, get evidence from conspiracy to riot, et cetera, et cetera. And then we'll arrest all the nasty people at the end of it and you'll go to court and they'll all go to prison.
Right. And why was Millwall targeted? Was every football club targeted?
There were a number, yeah.
Right.
There were a number of clubs.
And were
nationwide. And it was a political move.
Right. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, because it's because of the... it's Margaret Thatcher.
Mm-hmm.
There was the famous Millwall Luton riot. And as a result of that, she decided that she wanted to stamp it out.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that they chose to do that was by... Which is the same as it's now come out with the miners, is they were using people to infiltrate in order to get evidence.
Mm-hmm.
In order to be one step ahead of everybody. And so the political decision was that we'd use, or they would use, covert police officers in order to gain the evidence, in order to arrest people.
Were you aware of which of the clubs were being targeted?
We were aware, yeah, we were. Yeah.
So do you know?
Yeah, so Man City, Leeds, Arsenal, Chelsea, West Ham.
Okay, interesting. And would you were they the ones that were seen as the particularly problematic ones, or do you think it was random?
No. It were the ones that were considered to be problematic.
Mm. Okay.
And those that had that reputation.
Okay.
And that hooligan element.
Right, okay. So were you a football fan at that time? Were you aware
of... Not really.
So, again, that seems surprising to me. Cause
yeah, I knew it. I'd policed it, you know,
right.
Early on. And I'd been, when I was a kid, to Cheltenham with my dad and my granddad.
Mm.
But it wasn't really, you know, it wasn't something that attracted me.
Mm.
You know, I'd been and watched it and... You know, I hadn't even been involved in
mm-hmm.
hooliganism or, you know, in that travelling away or any of that sort of stuff.
So in preparation for introducing yourself to people at Millwall, did you have to do a load of research on the club?
I did.
Yeah.
Tons of research.
Right.
And sadly, the guy I worked with did none.
Oh, God. Right. Were you aware of that as you went into the situation?
Yeah, the first night was the biggest disaster in the history of the world.
Okay, let's go on to that.
So we went out the first night, went into a Millwall pub. No cover. He had this really frustrating ability to stare at people, and it's not a great thing in a pub,
yeah.
Particularly in one that you've never been in before.
Mm-hmm.
And he started staring at someone. I went to the toilet and came back, and he was surrounded. And
oh God!
They started questioning us, and he came out with that. And this is absolutely 100% true. Is we came out with a line that he thought that John Fashanu was white.
How'd you come back from that?
You don't. We got absolutely smashed.
What, beaten up? Did you?
Properly, yeah. First night out.
Oh, my God.
He thinks that John Fashanu is white and we get the absolute granny kicked out of us.
God. So at that point, how come the whole operation isn't...
Well, then he realised that he needed to do some fucking work.
Yeah. But how would you possibly get back in with the club if they're loaded?
Because he was so stupid.
Right.
And it was such a fucking stupid thing to say and do that he got away with it.
Yeah, I can see that, because you wouldn't think...
It actually, perversely, actually really helped.
Right. Yes, you would not think that anyone was trying to integrate with a football club would say that.
No.
So, yes, I can see that.
He just was not on his game. He got better.
Okay, so you go out the first night, say that one of the most famous of the time black footballers is white,
yeah.
Get beaten up, and then how does it progress from there?
Next day. Leeds away.
Okay.
Get there early on the football special, and there's nothing special about a football special, I can assure you.
Right.
We're going up, it's our first away game, and then we get the infamous no one likes us coming up the stairs, and as they come up the stairs, it's the guys that beat us up in the pub the night before.
And how did that go?
I just confronted them. There was no other option. We were going to have to... That was our moment. That was either we were going to completely and utterly fail, or we were going to have to take it head on, which is what we did.
So what did you do?
I just went up to them and said, you know, what the fuck was last night all about, etc. And then they started talking about it, and I just said, look, it ain't my fault, he's married to my sister. And the guy went, oh, married to the sister, hang on, we've all got one of those.
Right,
okay, I understand. And then we got on the train, met up with the guys that we then ultimately spent the next 2.5 years with.
And at that point, it was the beginnings of working into the group. Actually, one bit I just want to pick up, just for people who might not know, is you said when you came up at the stadium, you heard the chant, no one likes us. Can you just explain what that was?
So no, that's Millwall's anthem.
Mm.
So no one likes us, we don't care.
And why do you think that is their anthem?
Or... Because no one likes them very much and they don't really give a fuck.
Okay.
So that's why.
Okay, well, it makes sense. Do you think anyone could train themselves to do that? Or do you think there's something... Yeah.
No.
So what is it that gives you the ability to confront a group of people that beat you up the night before, knowing that you are exactly the sort of person they'd want to beat up?
Arrogance. An ability to try and do the best that you can in the job with what you've got. And so, therefore, pride. Not wanting to not succeed.
Mm.
And wanting to have that ability to see whether or not you can get yourself out of that situation.
Mm.
It's a really difficult thing to explain, but if you've not a quality that you've got, you know, the quality that you've got or that you want to use, it's not recommended. It's not a career route or career path that you would go, yeah, you should do that. But I mean, it's an amazing thing to be asked to do it at 20 years old.
Mm.
You know, 99.9% of other police officers would never get the opportunity to do.
So did you feel like a lot of trust had been, you'd been given a lot of trust to make this succeed at a young age?
Yeah, and you know, yes, in a way, but ultimately also it was, you know, it's a massive career move to be offered that at 20 years old, you know.
And how long did you think that job would be at the time?
Six months.
6 months, that's what you were told. And then the other quality, I suppose, that comes with it is some people are better at lying, some people are worse at lying.
Yeah.
But if you're inventing an entire personality, backstory, everything, and then you're putting that on while you interact with people and the mistake could be disastrous, is that something you can train to do, or is that just something that's in you to be able to present a different truth like that?
I think to do it well is something that you have to, it just has to be there.
Mm.
It's not, and obviously you get tricks, and now it's a completely different scenario. Now is there are, you know, you get your back cover, you get your backstories, you can do all the social media intervention, you know, you can do all of that stuff and create this fantastical person that isn't true, but you can make it online to make it look like it is. We didn't have any of that back then. So it was just your wits and effectively being able to convince people that you're something that you're not.
But I suppose that's interesting, isn't it? Because the social media can help because you can set up a backstory. But I guess back then, social media not existing might have been better because people can't look up and go, hang on, this guy's in that photo or he's friends with this person.
And then you've got, you know, and there's no mobile phones. And it was no email, no, you know, sort of little limited on that style. Back in, you know, sort of 87, we had pagers and that was about as good as it got.
Right.
We didn't get those until sort of 4 or 5 months in.
And was undercover work at that point a known thing? Like, would the hooligans that you were spending time with, would they have been suspicious of people?
Yeah, because they'd been on operation previously,
right?
And loads of people had just been arrested. We managed to slip in just as they'd been arrested, so it looked like we were sort of we didn't sort of come to it late. We came in, they then got arrested, and then we were all already sort of in because they were picking people off whilst we were still there, but. And they'd done the same at West Ham and they'd done the same at Chelsea.
And what are you feeling about the people at this point? Like, in your head, are you just indifferent? Are you just like, this is a job? Are you thinking, you are scum? Like, I'm going to take you out. It's better for society if you're in prison. Like, what's your feeling behind the scenes towards the people?
So our job was to take nasty, horrible people who want to beat people up for the sake of it out of circulation and send them to prison. The majority of the people that I came across were really nice guys.
Mm.
But there were an element that weren't very nice. And so the way I looked at it was, I'm going to make sure that the really nasty, horrible people get their comeuppance and get put away for what they're doing.
Mm.
The sad thing about that is there will be other people on the fringes that get dragged into that because that's just how it is.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority... So, the majority of the people that I infiltrated or I worked with or, you know, in relation to or against, how you want to look at it, were really nice guys.
Mm.
And I had a lot of time for them. They were just nice people.
Was that hardworking?
Not really.
No.
But there were an element of people that weren't very nice. It's just a bit like everything in life, isn't it? There's people you work with that most of them are right, but there's the odd dick.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with school. You're at school and it's like the most of the people you're at school with are right, but then there's the, you know, there's a collection of knobs. So, and it's just a bit like, it was a bit like that.
A microcosm of any other part of society.
Correct. And so what you do is you then just make sure that you focus your time, but sadly you then have to focus your time on the people that aren't very nice,
mm-hmm.
you don't really want to spend time with, but have to because you have to gain the evidence.
And was any of that did you start to, I mean, we might get onto it later, but did you start to feel any guilt around that with the people that you thought were nice, or was it still just, this is a job?
It's a job.
Yeah.
And I know it's bizarre, but that's the only way you can deal with stuff like that. It was my job. My job was to be as convincing as I could be, get as much evidence as I could. The operation would then conclude and I would then move on.
Mm-hmm. So how do you then move from the periods where you're kind of like trying to introduce yourself to different groups of people and get involved, how do you get further integrated into that group, and how do you sort of make your way into the inner circle?
It just takes time. And what we did was, there was a real Millwall pub, and we started going there in there at lunchtimes when they weren't frequented by, they were just frequented by local people. So we started going into the pub at lunchtime, and we did that for 3 months. So when we turned up for the next season, because we started in the March, so we had a little bit of the football, and then we finished, and we had the summer, and then we did bits and pieces, and then all the research and all the bits that we needed, that we certainly needed, he needed to do anyway, the sergeant. We got to September, when we walked into the pub for the first game, all the barmaids knew us.
Right.
Because we walked in, oh, Jim, how are you? It's really, really good to see you, so-and-so. What do you want? Your usual, and all that stuff. Instantly, you've got a level of acceptance. So it's then, once you've got that, you've taken those steps, then it makes the process moving forward a bit easier. Still not, you know, simple, but it makes that process a bit easier.
And then is it a case of just starting to chat to people in the pub and just say, oh, you know, just starting that?
Yeah, the landlord was a real top, was one of Millwall's top guys.
Right.
And a really nice bloke.
Right.
And he had some problems with someone outside with nicking his garden furniture, and I got lucky. I ran out with him. You know, we sorted it out. We got the garden furniture back, and I sort of got accepted on that level.
Got you.
So we were a bit lucky on that front.
How does it work with, like, say you'd run out there, caught the guy, and the landlord had started to beat him up, and you're undercover, and you're thinking, yeah, how does that, like, what level can you go to protect your cover?
You go to whatever you have to go to in order for that to, you know, for you to do your job. I mean, there's levels, but ultimately it's really, really, really fine line. And again, it's a real head fuck, because your head is going, you've got, am I going to get beaten up? Do I need to get involved? Because if I don't get involved, is he then going to think, why are you not getting involved? Mm-hmm. Do I not want to get, you know, if he gets too involved, if he hurts the guy, am I then going to put myself in a position where it's just, you've got all of that going on, milliseconds making those decisions.
And when you say it, I presume it's not written down anywhere. So it's up to you eventually to justify. Like, if you had to,
you can justify anything,
right?
In relation to what you're doing, would be my argument. It's about, and about justification is, well, if I'd done that, I would. And that's the sort of the problem, and certainly what's come out with certain other operations that have gone on over time. Is about, you know, is it morally right? Is it, you know, how far do you go? What are your levels? Is, you know, you just have to take a view and make a decision at that time as to, you know, what do I do? Like the famous one for me was the Crystal Palace guy on the train.
Can we hear about that?
Beaten up. So we're with a guy, had I known 8 months further, if we'd been 8 months, 12 months, further on into the operation, then my reaction would have been different. But it was relatively early on.
Mm-hmm.
So with a guy, he was sitting. There was a guy with a Crystal Palace badge on, sitting with his wife and his two kids, and we were with this guy that we just met, who was being vocal about wanting to go to London Bridge and have a fight and all that stuff. So we went with him, and he just attacked the guy on the train.
Who was sitting with his family?
He was sitting with his family. Like, and I mean, punched him, kicked him, got him on the floor. I mean, completely unprovoked, completely unnecessary. And you're watching this, and in front of this guy doing it in front of his kids, which is, you know, and I got further on into the operation. No one would ever do that. It's just because the guy was a fucking arsehole.
Yeah.
And what he should have done is jumped on him and given him a slap too. I said, what the fuck are you doing? Because it's just not what, it's not, you know, it doesn't work like that.
Right, right.
And, but we were early on. And so.
Right. So if you'd known how it worked, it would have been.
If I'd been further on in, right, and have had more, you know, I knew more about what I was doing, but,
yeah,
you know, I was more confident and I was more aware and I had, you know, I was with, then that situation would have been dealt with completely differently.
So what? So the guy wearing the Crystal Palace jumper with his kids, he got beaten up, and then what? He just sat there on the train beaten up with his.
Well, family. He sat there crying with his wife and his two kids.
It was
horrendous. Of all of the things in the whole of the operation, it was the worst day. because you feel so useless. And you know, so all you could, so I just jumped up and started singing No One Likes Us to try and, and it worked. And he stopped.
To join in singing with you.
And just the look from the kids and the wife and, you know, this poor man having just you know, just minding his own business, going to London with his kids. He's just been brutally attacked by this guy.
And no one called the police or stopped the train or there's...
But no one does, mate.
Yeah.
And no one could call the police. It wasn't a time with mobile phones or no one would record it and then put it on, and this is the, anyone know this guy? It wasn't about any of that.
Yeah.
So that all we could hope was that he would report it. We knew who he was, so we have a crime. And then over time, you would then be arrested for it.
Right.
But the guy never reported it.
And you can't log that as something that happens, so when the operation wraps up...
We did.
Right, okay.
We did, but we need a victim.
Okay, I see. Right.
And we didn't have one.
Wow, that must have been... Yeah, I can see why that was a hard moral...
It was absolutely horrendous.
Yeah.
You know, and there are days that you pick out where, you know that you'll never forget. You know, there are a number of situations and circumstances on the day that you just go, right, you know, and there's three or four of those where you just think back and you go, right.
Ones that stay with you.
Yeah.
Were there any situations like that but where you felt in danger?
Arsenal away.
Mm-hmm.
When we ended up in the North Bank, it was an FA Cup game, and I ended up just... with a group of hardened Millwall in the Arsenal North Bank.
Okay, so for anyone who doesn't quite get what that means...
That means going in Highbury as it was then. So it's not now the Emirates, but it was Highbury.
That's the Arsenal Stadium.
So the Arsenal Stadium, Highbury, in the home end, so the Arsenal home end.
Mm-hmm.
And we're the away supporters. And there was 15 of us in the Arsenal North
Bank. How did you end up there?
Just the landlord from the pub and... 15 other guys that were 14 other guys that were with him, and we ended up.
Did they want to be there?
Yeah, they were.
So that was the.
I didn't want to really be there, to be fair. No. but we had the situation where they're going, "Oh, come with us. What are you going to do?"
So what? They just want to go to.
They just went in. We stood in the Arsenal North Bank, surrounded by 8,000 Arsenal, and they then start singing "No One Likes Us."
Oh God! And then what happened?
Well, the sergeant by that stage had fucked off.
from the operation or from that day?
From that situation.
Right.
He just was up the top and just went, oh, no, which was wise.
Yeah.
He gone. They started singing No One Likes Us. And you're in the middle of it thinking, I'm going to die here. And they were big, grown men in their 30s and 40s. I was a 20-year-old guy in a pair of dungarees. Thinking, right, okay. Standing there.
So what happened?
Well, it went really quiet. And then the sort of crowd moved out. And then as we were singing. And then we stopped. And then this one guy came forward and obviously looked at me because I was the smallest
mm-hmm.
and the youngest, clearly, and came running towards me to hit me. And then the landlord... just took one step in front of me and just went and hit this geezer straight on the nose so hard that he almost did this somersault and landed and clattered onto the concrete terrace. And it was so bad that all of the Millwall and all of the Arsenal went as he hit the ground. And then these like two little guys came out from nowhere. It was like sort of, I've spoken about this before, it was a bit like Ben-Hur.
Mm.
Just grabbed him by the ankles and the crowd opened up and they dragged him in and then the crowd closed and then everyone just piled in.
And then it was just a fight?
It was just fucking free-for-all. And the one thing you do learn in all of this is that you never go down.
Right.
Whatever you do, you go down and you are absolutely, completely and utterly fucked. So you just go, I was just windmills.
God.
And then ended up spilling out onto the pitch. Got nicked. And then, because at that stage, there were like two sort of people that police football. There were the people that drive a desk and eat cake in the week
mm-hmm.
and then do football on Saturday for overtime.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the tactical support group, who were affectionately known as the thick and stupid group, who would have shields and thing just were up for a fight. So that's not a great mix. You've got a fat bloke who doesn't really want to be there, who's getting overtime and wants to eat cake. And then you've got a lot of other guys running around with shields who just want to beat the shit out of everyone. So fortunately, I got nicked by the cake keeper. And he took me the wrong way around the ground. Instead of going that way, he went that way and took me towards 10,000 Millwall.
Right, okay.
And I managed to break free and run and dive in the crowd. So.
And they just took you in?
That was it. And then I was sort of, from that moment, it was, for me, I was in really.
Yeah, because presumably they see that and go,
they do.
Legend.
Yeah.
God. So did the guys that you'd been on the other side with, did anyone get battered? Did anyone get badly beaten up, or was it?
Not really.
Yeah.
Okay. Never saw most of them ever again.
Right, okay. And was that how it was? You'd turn up to these matches and there'd just be groups of random men that you'd never
met one,
before? Right.
I'd never seen, obviously I knew the landlord, but I hadn't seen some of the other guys.
Okay.
I never saw them again.
So it's interesting because you said earlier that the landlord was a great guy and really nice, but then at the same time he's someone that seems to have like a predisposition for enjoying quite extreme violence.
Yeah, but it was Arsenal away, wasn't it? So
sure, but he'd actively gone and...
Yeah.
Yeah. But you could you reconcile that at that point with someone that you go, oh, he's a good guy, he just loves battering people?
No, he would have got nicked.
Right. Okay.
But he didn't. Mm. But he would have done.
Okay. All right, so that sounds like you've done a pretty good job of sort of ingratiating yourself with them. Were there any points where you came close to getting exposed?
Yep. So we had one day where, again, the sergeant I'd worked with had told him that we'd been working on a house because our cover was painters and decorators.
Yeah.
Giving them the address because he was pissed. And they'd come down to see us, and obviously there were people there working on the roof and we weren't there.
Right.
And they said, I don't know who you're talking about.
Oof.
So we got confronted in the pub.
This is further into it, is it?
Yeah, this was about 8 months in.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Who the fuck are you? Which is a fair question.
Yeah. And there was still, so there was still even 8 months in, and after all this stuff, there was still...
Oh, they were questioning everyone.
Right.
Everyone was getting questioned, not just everyone. And I was questioning everyone.
Yeah. Right. Okay. It's, yeah.
It's the best scenario, isn't it? It's just, you question everyone too. So you're just like double bluff. Who the fuck are you? I've never seen you here before.
Yeah. And how did you get out of that?
Well, they said to me,
yeah, yeah,
who are you? And I said, you know who I am. And that was the point when it was we either confess and we run or we front up.
Mm.
And so I just fronted up. And it got very, very, very close to becoming quite a physical altercation. And everyone wanted to believe that we weren't.
Mm.
And so me and one of the guys it got quite physical. And then he just went, oh, and I walked out the pub. And that was the day when I knew then that I had to do something that was going to convince them 100% I wasn't Old Bill. But I needed to try and make sure that it was legal. But I needed to do something.
And what did you end up coming up with?
We went to another pub. And they started playing. There was this computer girl. There was a game called Dave Lee Travis's Pot Black thing, right?
Okay.
Play this thing, right? Where you'd answer a Red Bull question, and it was one question. It was really easy, and then you'd pick either a different colour of the snooker. So the easiest question was yellow. The hardest question was black.
Okay. Yeah.
So they started playing the game for drinks, and I just got up for my question. They looked at it. Didn't answer her, fuck it, I'll get the beers, went away, got the drinks, came back. And I could see everyone looking at me, thinking, the fuck is he doing? And then it came to me again, and this is no word of a lie, the question was, who won the World Cup in 1966? So I'm looking at it, they're all screaming at me, if I can answer it, you know, Jim, answer it. And then I just grabbed the sergeant by the throat, who had no idea what I was doing. And I was just like, why have you fucking told him? Why have you told him? You've told him. And he's like, well, I don't know what you're going on about. And he didn't have a clue what I was going on about. And I just went, you know, it's not my fault. I can't read or write. And he went, I haven't told him. Then went outside. 10 minutes or 5 minutes later, they all come out and said, oh, no, we didn't know. Honestly, you know, so sorry. So, you know, we didn't know about it. I'm really sorry. We didn't mean to put you in that position. And then I'm waiting and waiting for the fucking for it to drop when they suddenly go, and it did. And one of them just turned around and went, fucking hell, look. My God, you just, as you accusing him of being old Bill when he can't even read or write.
Ah, okay.
Which was a brilliant move for that day, but the shittiest move if you think about it, because I then end up for 18 months having to make out I can't read or write.
Right. So...
which is a lot harder than it sounds.
No. I mean, it's because even stuff like going in, like when you're reading train things, or you're going on a train or whatever, and you're saying, like, what does a ticket say? You have to...
And they all take the piss. So it's like you're driving and they go, come off here. And you know it's the wrong turn off. And you come off and it's like, ah, what are you doing coming off here? Can't you read? And all that. And, oh, right, okay. Was it the wrong turning then? And then you come back on and your stuff.
So what's interesting to me about that is that I would have imagined that if you were going to come up with such a big thing like that, you would have had to have gone and told some sort of superior officer, and they would have gone, look, this is the benefits of doing it. This is the problems with doing it. Let's talk it through.
Let me just give you an example of what you're dealing with with senior police officers at that time. Mm-hmm. Okay. We had a massive meeting at Scotland Yard in relation to the West Ham game. Okay. Which is Millwall West Ham is always is one of the biggest games in relation to potential for violence, because they fucking hate each other. Mm-hmm. So we go, the sergeant goes and gives this presentation, and then at the close of it says, you know, we've been doing really well, and you know, Jim's done this great thing, and he can't read or write. And one of the senior officers stops in mid-flow and goes, what do you mean he can't read or write? And he said, well, yeah, he can't read or write. And he said, if he can't read or write, how on earth did he get through training school? And you're like, no, I can read or write. It's part of my cover. What the fuck? Of course I can read and write. Oh, right. For a minute, I thought we had an illiterate policeman. And you're like, fucking, there's a thought.
Right.
That is genuinely the fucking level of incompetence and people you were dealing with.
And I suppose the lack of understanding about what you were doing.
Totally. And you just come out and go, we haven't got a fucking open air.
Right.
No wonder we're walking around with a business card.
And when you're getting further involved like this, and you're making up these extended cover stories, is the fact that you're based 3 miles away, is that becoming more and more?
We changed all that.
You changed it. So
we got looked after by an unbelievably brilliant police officer.
Right.
He was working for Greater Manchester Police at the time. He was running a covert team for them.
What? So he sort of took over and said, "This is."
He just went. How on earth are you surviving? You need this, got us everything.
Okay, great.
And so embarrassed the Metropolitan Police, embarrassed them into helping us. Mm. Saying, if you don't do this, I will. And then they started to take us seriously.
As you're progressing like that, does it start to take a mental toll? Like basically lying every day to people that you're spending extended periods of time with, because you said earlier that a lot of them are nice people and people that you thought were just hardworking.
It's not easy.
Yeah.
But no job is. Mm. You know, it's not easy. It's just, it's, but it's, you just get used to it. Mm. It does, you know, it's like people go, oh, you know, when were you, when did you feel the most scared, or when was it the most, it's dangerous the entire fucking time. Mm. Because you can be in a supermarket with your missus shopping and bump into someone. So you're forever, always. You know, I'd never ever sit in a restaurant, and I can't now. I'd never sit in, my mates and family will laugh about the fact that I can't sit with my back to the door. I have to sit in the restaurant at the back of the restaurant so I can see everything that's going on. Everyone who comes in, everyone, even now. It's just because it's just become part and parcel, and it's now, you know, it's now become amusing, but it's it is what it is. Mm. I'm not good at it, and because of that, it's because I need to be at that point. I needed to be careful. I needed to be aware of my surroundings. So, that it's one of the drawbacks or disadvantages of doing stuff like that is that's difficult to break that cycle.
Did you live in London at that time?
Yeah.
So we did a piece before with another undercover cop, but he was a narcotics officer.
Yeah.
So he was from London, but he was doing Manchester or Birmingham. Was that normal that you would be living near where you were doing your undercover work?
It's not ideal. Mm. But again, back then it's just, you know, it is what it is. Mm. You know, I came from Wandsworth. At that time I was living in West Norwood. And then I moved out to the country. Mm.
And were you, how were your personal relationships? Like, can you tell people that are close to you what you're doing, or does it have to be a secret from everyone?
Not really. Mm. They tend to, you suddenly go from being 12 stone and relatively fit to 15 stone with long hair and not overly fit and overweight, because drinking and eating takeaway food and stuff takes its toll.
Mm. And so did you have a partner at the time?
I did.
And would they ever say, you know, what's going on? Is everything?
She knew.
Yeah, she, okay, right.
Yeah, she knew.
Must have been sort of a frightening for her.
Yeah, I think she just, it was just.
It's who you were. Yeah.
It was just, you know, I tried not to bring it home. It's difficult, but yeah. I tried not to.
Yeah.
But it was, but you do, you know, you'd be lying if you turned around and said it was all easy and plain sailing, and it was obviously had its moments.
And what about your mates, like your best mates? Could you tell them or?
Did I tell my? I didn't really have much to do with it because I didn't want to put them in that position.
Yeah,
because my best mates weren't police officers. All my best mates were people I grew up with on an estate in South London, who were all doing their own thing.
Right, okay.
Some of which was legal, most of it which wasn't. Most of the mates I grew up with, I think certainly 50% of them went to prison.
Wow. So you just kept all that separate, what you did?
Yeah, because it wasn't fair on them.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Okay, so let's talk about how that operation started to come to an end.
We had the Chelsea trial collapsed, the West Ham trial collapsed, the Millwall trial, people got sent to prison. And then latterly, they appealed and they also got released.
Oh, wow. How long was it that all got wrapped up?
So that was happening whilst we were working. The Chelsea, the Headhunter trial and the West Ham trial both collapsed.
Because you'd expected it to last 6 months, hadn't you, initially? And how long was it?
We were 2.5 years the operation lasted.
Wow.
So we were just over 2 years in when it all started to go wrong.
Okay, for the previous trials.
Yeah, and the Chelsea trial and the West Ham trial collapsed, quite rightly, because the police officers lied. They made shit up because they hadn't managed to do their job, so they made it up.
Oh, no.
And they got found out. You know, they've got people that are being involved in disturbances and fights and stuff who've got video footage of them at a wedding. You know, so they couldn't have been at the football because there's a video of them at the. So it then you then put into question all of the other evidence, and it then started to just unravel, and it just fell apart. And so both those trials collapsed, and then it started to become about not losing face. And again, it was a. From what we understand, a political decision where they just went, they need to stop.
So, right. So they didn't even bring it to trial. But so what happened to the body?
Got a phone call, mate. We were sitting in the office.
Yeah.
We were going on an away match on the Saturday. We got a phone call on the Tuesday saying to the sergeant, and he went, answered the phone. He went, right, okay. Well, all right, fine. I'll let everyone know. Put the phone down. He went, we're done. We're finished. Operation's concluded.
After 2.5 years?
Yep.
I mean, how did that feel?
Pretty shit.
Like, disappointed, angry, sad? What was the...
All of those.
Yeah.
I mean, at the time, I remember at the time that my main annoyance was the fact that Millwall were actually in the first division and doing quite well, and we weren't going to go and get to watch much of any more of the games that season. That was one of my first reactions. Yeah, and then they decided that no one was going to be arrested.
Oh, they weren't even going to try and act on any of these?
It was just concluded overnight, done.
But how could they justify that? The money that has gone on the whole operation?
Ask them.
So no explanation, just it's over, we're not arresting anyone, done. Get out.
You're not to go back to Millwall. You're not going back to Millwall. You're to have 2 weeks off. And then for me, you're to go back to Alpington and drive a panda car.
Okay, hang on. So 2.5 years of your life has gone into this, and they just say you don't go back ever again.
Yeah,
and you're going back just to a regular
to Alpington to drive a panda car.
to anyone who doesn't know what that is, a panda car is a police car in the UK. But so how do you, like, so was that it? Or did you extract yourself somehow? Did you make up a cover story for leaving? Did you say, like...
It would make sense, wouldn't it? That was it. It's done.
So you just never went back?
No. That was it.
Did that not feel like, in a weird way at that point, like a big part of your life had just been lost? Like the people you were seeing every day?
What it did is it made me realise at that point that I need to be in control of my own destiny and that I need to put myself in a position where no one is ever going to make a decision about what I'm doing that I cannot be in control of. That's what that did. Where I went, right, learn from this. I'm 23 years old. I'm going to make sure that I never put myself in a position where somebody is going to be able to tell me that I can't do something or that I'm going to be stopped from doing something because of the fact that they haven't got the arsehole to push on with it, or somebody else somewhere has decided that we're not going to do that anymore.
So I guess you didn't drive that panda car.
I fucking left. That was it. I was done. 6 weeks and I was out. Which was, out of all of the decisions about working undercover and doing all the bits and pieces, was the bravest decision of the lot for me, because it's all I'd known since I was 18 and a half. I've got to what I consider to be an elite officer doing stuff that the majority of other people will never get to do, for it all to be concluded on a phone call.
And at that point, were you seen as an elite officer, or was the whole thing seen as a slightly embarrassing, let's not talk about it anymore?
Yeah, that's how it was seen.
Right. So did you feel quite betrayed by the force at that point?
I mean, we think we all did, to be fair.
Yeah.
Although the other three guys all stayed in.
And just got repositioned in different areas.
Yep.
Wow.
The sergeant went back to Lewisham as a desk sergeant, which is 1 mile away from Millwall's football ground.
And did anyone ever get in any...
Yeah, they did. So one of the guys got nicked and came in, and he was there in uniform to charge him. And came in and went, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "Well, really sorry, I'm a policeman." And he looked at him and went, "So I wouldn't want to be you when Jim finds out." Because he still believed that I was... Jim from Wandsworth, who couldn't read or write, even though he was looking at the guy that I did it with. And as I was standing there as a policeman in uniform, yeah.
Do you think they all eventually found out?
They did all find out.
Who you were?
Yeah, they did.
How do you think they would have processed that?
I met one of them because I was doing a film for Channel 4, and I went, because again, I thought they wouldn't recognise me because I'd lost so much weight and was... I went back there I was doing a film with for Channel 4, and I went back with a couple of the actors, and I bumped into one of them, and the two actors absolutely shit themselves because they knew what I'd done. And then all of a sudden, one of the guys, and he just went, "What are you doing here? You on Brave Pills or what?" And I just went, "Well," and the guys with was quite a famous actor, just went, "Oh, no, we're here, we're acting, you know, we're just, he's an actor, yeah, we know who he is, mate." He said, "I've been watching you because I became an actor, and you know, said we've seen you in doing stuff, and we saw your episode of The Bill when we did this, but we don't really think you should come back here anymore because some people won't be quite so pleasant if they see you."
Do you still, at that point, you know, when we talked about you as a younger person, sort of having, not feeling the fear that I think a lot of people would have felt as a slightly more mature person going back to that situation and being confronted, was it the same deal, or are you in a place now where you would think, "Oh, shit"?
I've been World War a few times. Yeah, it's just, you know, no one got nicked. It was a job. No one got arrested. Nobody got sent to prison. I was just doing my job. Some people have a problem with that, which is their right. You know, I've met with a few of the guys. I did a one-man show based on, I wrote a book about what I did, and then did a one-man show on that, which was really successful and did really, really well. And a few of the guys that were involved came and saw it, and I had chats with them afterwards.
The landlord, you ever seen him since?
No.
How do you think he'd feel?
I don't know. Apparently, somebody said he was... He found it highly amusing that I'd managed to get away with that.
And then
they didn't have a desire to sort of seek me out.
No, no, you're not following each other on Twitter or anything like that.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
See, if you were walking down the street and you saw him, just the two of you walking to facing each other, would you turn around and go down a side street, or would you be like, oh, all right, you know, how would you feel about bumping into people from
that? I wouldn't have a problem with that. I haven't got a problem with bumping into people. I've got no shame about what I did.
Mm.
You know, there's a lot of people that would have a problem with it if you want to put it in their face, but mm-hmm. I would not look to do that.
Mm.
You know, I'm happy to have a conversation with anyone about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, it was a job. It's what I did. I was 21 years old.
So ID was a film that, am I right in saying it was made about this operation?
Yeah.
And how did that come about as something people were aware of? Because presumably at the time, if the police were kind of trying to just cover it over a little bit, how did that end up becoming a film script?
So I was doing a play, I was doing a second season. So I was doing Sarah Kane, who was a famous playwright, who sadly is not here anymore. I was doing a collection of her work.
Mm.
She was directing me in some work. And her partner at the time was a guy who's a writer. And he had a conversation with me about writing down my story and said you should write it down. So I went back and wrote it and gave it to him, which was the original story. And then he wrote, based on the original story, he wrote a treatment which he gave to a number of film production companies. And everyone wanted it.
Mm.
It became a sort of one of those scripts that within a week everyone was talking about it and everyone wanted to do it. And... he then wrote the screenplay and it got made. And Phil Davis directed it. He did an amazing job with what he had, really. Like, really good job. And, and my idea for writing it was because I wanted a part in it.
Because
I wanted to be an actor. You know, I was an actor at the time and that's what I wanted to do. And that was my drive, was because I just wanted some work. And I got a part in it. And then the day before they started filming, they told me I couldn't be in it.
Oh, right.
Because everyone was portraying the film as a piece of fiction. They didn't want anyone to know that it was true.
Okay.
because at that time, they were nervous about what the police would do.
And right,
whether they would accept it or not.
So try they made and close out it
that
down.
So they made out that it wasn't true, even though it was. Parts of it were factually correct. But a large part of it, certainly the drive of the story. So I ended up with the film being made, nobody really knowing that it was about me and not being able to be in it.
Mm. Disappointing.
Yeah, hugely. Yeah, it was, yeah, because it was, you know, it was, I mean, I wanted to play me, but it was, I was naive, I suppose, in a way. But lots of people liked that film.
Mm. It became like a cult classic, didn't it?
It has, yeah, no, it is. It is a, you know, lots of people quote lines from it and know it and are now aware of the fact that it is, you know, and it's quite a cool thing to have a film made about you by the time you're 30 and you're not dead or in prison. So I suppose there's, you know, that's quite a good thing to have, I suppose. It's just that, would it have been the film I made, would have made? No.
Does it? You know, spoiler alert, but it has been out for like 30-odd years, so yeah. I don't think it's too bad to give a spoiler. But the end of the film sees the main character basically losing his mind, essentially, doesn't it? Like, you can't... It's sort of ambiguous at the end whether he knows he's undercover still or if he's completely lost his mind and gone into that side of it and become a football hooligan and now that's what his identity is. You seem like someone who's got like a very strong sense of yourself. And so it doesn't seem like something that would have happened to you. But do you think people in that position could have been affected in that kind of a way?
Yeah, it's a film. I can see why he, you know, the guy who wrote the film chose to go that route. I didn't agree with it at the time, and I don't agree with it now. But then that's because I'm just looking at it from having had a personal experience. But yeah, there are people that go into that work in that environment who don't come out of it quite as fortunate as I did.
Mm. And where do you, in terms of you and your relationship with, are you able to watch football anymore? Or, you know,
I'm much more into rugby, mate.
Okay. And when you look back now over your life and the experiences you had, and I know that you had a lot of experiences post that job, but when you look back at your life, like, what's something you think you've learned? Like, what's your life taught you?
Trust yourself. Don't be afraid of taking a leap or a chance. And be mindful of others. So effectively treat people how you want to be treated yourself. And because there are lots, and you can fuck a lot of people up on the way up, but you're going to need them when you come back down, because everyone will always come back down.
Mm-hmm.
At some point. You're going to do something and you're going to falter and you're going to come back. And you want to make sure that all those people that you've been nice to on the way up are going to help you get back up to where you are. And I've had that on a couple of occasions.
Okay, look, James, you're someone that's had a fascinating life, and I think we could have spent 2 or 3 hours in this conversation, but unfortunately it's come to an end. But thanks so much for coming and sharing your story.
Pleasure.
It is incredible, and it's one that I know people will be genuinely interested to listen to.
Right.
Thanks for coming in.
No worries. Thanks very much.